Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, October 14th. And then there were two. We hear from the candidates on the short list for the job as University of Hawaii president. Both finalists have just wound up community meetings across the state and are heading back to convince the Board of Regents who is the better fit for the UH system. Collecting stories of growing bees in Kona, we learn about a new exhibit showcasing this rich history. And making music at the Hawaii Symphony, we get to know its new chief executive officer. New energy and buzz around concerts by our classically trained musicians. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The two finalists for the top job at the University of Hawaii wrapped up their public meetings across the state. They will be interviewed by the Board of Regents on Wednesday. Today we hear from them. This morning we talked to Julian Vasquez Heilig, a Stanford PhD graduate. He is currently provost and vice president for academic affairs at Western Michigan University. HPR first raised the questions about whether the interview and deliberation process for the board ought to be more transparent. It's an issue that has been raised at the school board level and in other executive searches. And some attorneys are calling on the board not to keep this part of the process behind closed doors. Here's Heilig.
I think one of the things I have noticed about the search process at Hawaii is how open it has been to this point in terms of having a website completely dedicated to this, all of the forums online, extensive requests for feedback. I don't think I've ever seen a presidential search with this much community engagement, which quite frankly is what really attracts me to the job in general, is this opportunity for community engagement. Now, I'm not aware of what the specific statute is regarding open meetings related to interviews like this. I've read a little bit about what the precedents are and those types of things. So quite frankly, I will just leave that to the lawyers. But I do appreciate how much interaction I've been able to have with the community, even though there's so many more conversations that need to be had.
Let's say you were sitting on the Board of Regents. Do you think you might ask that the process be in an open setting?
I think I'd have to think about that one. And I think, you know, with any decision that leaders make, I think you have to have all the information in front of you. And in this case, the statute, what general counsel thinks about it, that's just how, as a leader, I go about making decisions, is trying to get with my team and gather as much information as I possibly can. And I quite frankly, don't think I'm in the position to assess that if I were a regent. That's just very difficult for me to do. But, you know, if I was a regent and I was in this position, that's the process that I would go about.
And was there anything in this interviewing process as you were traveling across the state to meet with the community that you were struck by?
Really, it was just a joyful experience for me to have the Oli and to be welcomed on campus in Hilo, to landing in Kauai and learning about all the incredible career opportunities that they have there and the entrepreneurship work that's happening there. It was just an incredibly joyful experience. And to me, it's one of the things that makes this work so special. A lot of presidencies are really focused on donor work and sports, and, you know, those things are important to Hawaii, but there's so much more to this work, especially the community engagement piece. The other piece that makes this unique also is working with the legislature, being that about half of the funding comes from the legislature. So this is a really special opportunity, and that's really what's attracted me to this. And that was just reinforced with all the conversations that we had. And that was a very difficult process because we were up at about 4 a.m. every day, and we went to about 9 o'clock each day, and we had 6 forums each day. So there's 12 forums in 48 hours. But it was still just absolutely a joyful experience.
Given your background, what would your vision for diversity be at the University of Hawaii?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that work has to be driven by community. And so what we've been able to do in my past roles, and I'll talk specifically about the role here, it's difficult for me to go to a community and say, here are my best ideas for you. And so, for example, with the Pool Cola Council, when we had our conversation, my question to them was, where are the opportunities, where are the challenges that you see, and how can we work together around initiatives, approaches, data dives? So I think that's really important work is going to the communities and getting the best ideas. We've done that here with the Indigenous and Native community, with the African American community, with the veteran community, and quite a few other groups. And that's, if you could see me, if we were on Zoom right now, behind me I have a wall of ideas that are community generated. Because I always say that 90% of the best ideas come from community. And it's very important for those ideas to have champions in the community. I focus on community engaged, community based leadership, because that is how you get that work. If you think about, I was watching some video on Hawaii News Now about the canoe races that are happening right now. If you think about the canoe races, the way that they do that with speed and with precision is that they're paddling together. And that's the work that you have to do as president with different communities, is you have to paddle together.
I do have to ask you about your position on charter schools, because that may have raised some eyebrows, because, you know, Hawaii has embraced this concept of charter schools.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. It's important to understand how charter schools operate on the continent. Charter schools on the continent, quite a few of them are run by very large corporations, either for-profit or non-profit. They look very, very different on the continent than they do in Hawaii. And so the key is, you know, and I had a chance to actually meet some Hawaiian charter school educators at a recent education conference. And they talked about the Hawaiian knowledge and the Hawaiian language acquisition and teaching and pedagogy and curriculum. And I was blown away. They talked about how their students are more successful in many cases. These are the stories that they told me. And so Hawaii, in many ways, and this is just one example, are a completely different context than the continent. So yes, the charter school research, the peer-reviewed research, and I've published almost 30 studies about different types of school choice, show some inequitable outcomes. And I think that's what everyone is really focused on when we're talking about education policy, is how do we create better outcomes for all students? And where we're not seeing that, we need to think about what other alternatives might be. And so I'm just really excited, actually, to be on site. There's a charter school at Hawaii Manoa, too. I'm excited to visit that school also. But I think it's important to understand that nuance, that the schools are very, very different on the continent than they are in Hawaii.
And then what do you say to people who might think that you might not have enough experience and might have to deal with some tough line of questioning over at the legislature, if you can hold your own over there?
Well, I think there's two parts to that question. I think one, talking about my academic background. First, I want to applaud anyone who has made it to the end of my 50-page CV. So I appreciate if you were able to do that. But I think the main thing we have been focused on, whether it has been at the University of Texas at Austin, which is an R1, where I served as a vice chair and a program chair, or whether it is as a director at the largest system in the world at California State, or a dean, which is an R1 land grant, the University of Kentucky, or now as provost, overseeing 18,000 students and 800 faculty and 700 staff, and that's just academic affairs, and those are tenure-track faculty. We have many more faculty there, other faculty that are non-tenure-track. And so, you know, I've served as a provost and a dean at very large research universities for the last 5 years. But I think what attracted the committee to our work is the fact that we deliver results. So I think it's important to be a steady leader, but I also think it's important to deliver spectacular results. We, in just 2 years, have set a graduation record here on our campus. We also set a retention record, and we did that in just 2 years. And I fully expect that the recipe that we have for student success, which is using big data and people power to make sure that we can address the challenges that students have. Life happens to students. That we'll be able to set records for graduation and enrollment and retention at Hawaii in 2 to 3 years. I fully expect that we'll be able to do that. So in terms of the legislature, I'm a public policy scholar. And so I've worked with legislators in Texas Senate and House side, California Assembly and House side. In fact, the California Assembly actually passed a resolution about the work that we did together. Kentucky done work there. The governor made me a Kentucky colonel because of the public policy work. So that is my bailiwick, working with legislators. I wish I could start developing the relationship with the senators, with key senators. Folks out there know which key senators we're talking about with the House. I really enjoy that part of the work, working with the legislators and thinking about how we talk together about what the big needs are for the university and how we can find opportunities for innovation across the system.
You know, we have had some university presidents that came with, I don't know if you would say baggage, but they were distractions during their terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm aware. I mean, Dobell or Greenwood, you know, there was even critiques as far back as Simone, right? I was a history major at the University of Michigan, so I've very carefully studied the different presidencies over time. But I think the important common denominator of success in Hawaii is community and focus on community and being in community and also being able to be focused, laser focused on student success, faculty success, and staff success. I always say that leadership, you're called to leadership, you don't volunteer. And so when I was called to apply to this role, I wanted to see if it was the right fit. And ultimately, the community will decide if this vision of work that is community-engaged, community-based for the system is the right approach for the next 5 to 10 years.
Is there a fun fact you'd like to share with our audience?
A fun fact. A fun fact. Surprising at that one. Okay, a fun fact. Maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I decided that I wanted a Hawaii phone number. But I was living in California, and AT&T would not let me have an 808 phone number. So I would have an 808 phone number today if they would have allowed me many years ago.
Okay. Interesting. Well, if you get this job, I guess then you'll be eligible.
I'm ready for an 808 phone number. Let's do this.
Okay. All right. Well, Julia, thank you so much. It was fun to chat with you, and hopefully we get to meet face-to-face.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful day. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
That was Julian Vasquez Heilig, one of two finalists for the top job at the University of Hawaii. You know, he shares that for a time his sister worked as a nurse here at Queens and Kaiser and that he got engaged at Haleakala at Sunrise. We'll hear from the second finalist, Wendy Hensel, right after a break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
We get it. You want to stay informed, but there's a lot going on. HPR can help. Introducing the Akamai Recap. It's a roundup of local news stories, features, and moments you might have missed sent to your inbox every weekday afternoon. It's free, and it takes just 10 seconds to sign up. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/akamai.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Randy Hensel is Executive Vice Chancellor and University Provost for the City University of New York, known as CUNY. A Harvard Law graduate, she is trained as a lawyer and previously served at Georgia State University. She pushed back on allegations of bias reported in a recent Honolulu Civil Beat story. We asked her about that, but also about whether she supports the notion that the interview and deliberation process with the UH Board of Regents ought to be in an open forum instead of behind closed doors.
I think this has been a tremendously public experience, and that's all for the better, as people have a chance to get to know me and understand who I am. So I'm perfectly comfortable whatever the board decides, but it's not my call.
And you have had an opportunity to go out in the community and get some sense as to what people are concerned about. Have you been surprised by anything as you've talked to people?
No, I really haven't. I think maybe the surprise comes from the depth of the commitment to the University of Hawaii. I mean, that's been such a pleasure to see. I had people who attended multiple sessions and spent hours in an audience listening and asking questions, and that's not typical. And I think it expresses a real investment in the university, which is special, and also a realization of how really significant the responsibility and the awesomeness of the job is. So that was really great for me to see. It made me more excited about being here. But I think the questions were what you would expect and hopeful, but cautious with somebody that they don't know, as they should be.
Well, you know, I think President David Lassiter has been a real stabilizing force, you know, as was President McLean. And we did have some presidents that, I guess there was a lot of drama that came with their their term, if I put it that way. And I think, you know, the community just wants someone that's going to, you know, get down to business. And I think David will be leaving the university in a pretty good spot to grow. So what's your vision for the University of Hawaii?
I think as the premier access institution for an indigenous-fired place of learning, it is already a special place. That is very clear from my visit, and one that I would be extraordinarily fortunate to then come in and add to and build upon all of the great work that President Lassiter and the community has already done. I think there are, in the time that I spent really talking with people and looking at the data, I think there are areas of focus that could take the university to another level of access for people in the state. Things like more broadly available online education and automation and AI for student success and graduation and retention. I've done a lot of work in that space, and there's a lot of potential at the university to really make some major moves to serve students even more effectively than it already does. So I think it's ripe for the future and ready to be even greater than it is.
And what about its position, you know, let's say across the Pacific?
Obviously plays a really important role in location and geography and building upon that in terms of research and strategic partnerships. And frankly, in terms of workforce development, I think is an opportunity that certainly has been tapped into but could be taken even farther. And I would be very excited to be part of that conversation.
I'm curious, you know, if I read right, that you have a place on the Big Island. So this isn't your first trip here to Hawaii. You're familiar with, you know, how Hawaii ticks.
I've spent a lot of time in Hawaii. I was telling this story quite a bit over the course of the 3 days that I was in interviews. But I think like most people who are not born there, we're drawn there by the absolute beauty of the place and the specialness of the location. And over time, I fell in love with the people and the values and the culture. And my husband and I spent as much time there as we possibly could. And then finally decided we wanted to put down roots there. And I've been to all of the larger islands and been to almost every campus in the system long before I ever thought of applying for this position, just because I love higher education and I really love Hawaii and learning and understanding how it works over there. So this is a really exciting opportunity to combine the work that I love for populations that I love in the state that I love. So it's a wonderful, wonderful chance for me.
Now, diversity is a big deal over here. I don't know. How would you define diversity and what would your policy look like if you were the president of UH?
Well, I've spent my life at two highly diverse institutions, some of the most diverse in the country. Georgia State graduates more African Americans than any other university in the country. And CUNY has to be, if not the most diverse institution, then one of the most diverse institutions as part of New York City. And I've sought out those opportunities because that's the kind of population that I want to work with, people who are excited and eager to learn and deserve every chance and opportunity to make it. And I guess the way that I think about it, I think it's really evolved. You know, we started by talking about inclusion so that you have a seat at the table. And then we moved on to belonging, that you don't feel odd sitting at the table. I think at this point, my definition is that you matter, that when you're not at the table, the absence of your voice is noted and your voice needs to be heard. And I think that's an important grounding of all the work that I've done and part of the reason that I spend such a focus listening as part of my work, listening to understand and find community ways to move forward together in ways that are culturally sensitive.
There was just a recent article in Honolulu Civil Bee about, you know, allegations of bias that were leveled against you. How do you want to address those issues?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. There has never been a complaint of discrimination filed against me. And as I pointed out to the author of that article, the 35-page decision that was not filed against me never mentioned my name. And so it's simply false. People can, unfortunately, in public life, I think anybody who's in these positions understands people can say whatever they want. But there's also, you know, an environment where you need to show that. And I want people to know that not only has that never happened, never been a complaint filed against me and no finding of discrimination, but that my 25-year career demonstrates my commitment to diversity. And you can certainly speak with the school. They will back that up. And all of the thousands of people, highly diverse people that I've worked with over the years, that I'm really proud of that work and I stand by it.
My understanding is that the attorney for that professor, Tanya Washington, had, you know, made some allegations about your participation in a tenure review. Did you feel that maybe you needed to recuse yourself from that process?
I wasn't involved in it at all. And that's the point. I wasn't a witness. I wasn't called to speak. It wasn't filed against me. And it wasn't about a decision that I made. So I literally had nothing to do with that case. And I certainly did not sit in judgment on it as a provost. The woman who followed me, Nicole Parsons Pollard, who is the current provost, was the final decision maker in that case. I had nothing to do with it.
And so there, you didn't feel a need that you would have to recuse yourself?
There was nothing to recuse. Nothing ever came before me. I simply was not involved.
Did you feel a need then to even mention this as part of the search process?
In this particular case, no. At the time that I was hired by CUNY, this was an active case. And she certainly had made the allegation in the Freedom of Information Act, which, you know, is a request for information. And so at that time, I did inform the search firm of the allegation, although no formal complaint. And now we are many, many years later and no complaint has ever been filed. So nothing happened. No finding was had. No complaint was filed. There was nothing to report. But the search firm certainly was aware.
And then just trying to think if there's anything else that you want to say just as you head into your interview with the Regents.
Just that I recognize the incredible responsibility and the kuleana of the next president and how significant this institution is, how loved it is, how central it is to the community. And I feel that. And I look forward, if selected, to being a champion of the institution across the islands and being a really vested, long-term member of this community. And I appreciate the consideration.
All right. Okay. And then I don't know if anyone's warned you about the lawmakers have been accused of meddling in often university affairs. And I don't know, someone said that, gosh, the next president better have some tough skin, you know, because there are folks who feel that there are bullies at the state legislature and that you've just got to be able to handle yourself in that venue. But I don't know. Any thoughts about that? Has anyone warned you?
Many people have warned me.
Okay.
That certainly was raised as an issue in, mm-hmm. in the open forums. And I'd say a couple things. First of all, I'm a trained lawyer. Mm-hmm. I'm a discrimination lawyer. This is the work that I do, and a litigator. And so I'm comfortable in an environment of question and answer. And at CUNY, we serve two legislatures. The city council of the city of New York funds our community colleges, and the state funds our senior colleges. And those are, I don't think anyone has ever claimed New York was a soft place. Some tough questioning there. And I think a very legitimate interest, and I've said this repeatedly, of course they're interested in the university. They're clear partners and need to be synergistic in working toward workforce development goals and meeting the needs of its citizens. And so I would really welcome the opportunity to be a partner and to do proactive and regular engagement before challenges arise, as they, you know, inevitably do in these roles that we play. And I think the question is really, at what point does it become micromanagement that's damaging to the institution? And those are things that people of good faith can work out and recognize that the people sitting in the university, running the university, understand things and see things that simply can't be seen from the outside, and work collaboratively to find solutions together.
Well, is there a fun fact you can share that maybe you think folks don't know about you that maybe hasn't come out in any of the forums?
Fun fact, I took an aerobics class with Sandra Day O'Connor at the Supreme Court.
Oh, cool, no right? Kidding. Oh, my
yep,
gosh.
Yep, I was lucky enough to be an intern at the United States Supreme Court while she was there. And the gym above the courtroom is called the highest court in the land. Because it literally is higher than the courtroom.
Oh, that's so cool.
And because I know, and because it was built with only one facility, because only men were there at the time, only women could take the class with Justice O'Connor. So I really enjoyed that moment, and it was one for the ages for sure.
That was Wendy Hensel, one of two finalists in the running for president of the University of Hawaii. The board is to meet formally interview them on Wednesday and could announce its decision as early as Thursday.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Monday marks 1 year since Israel was attacked by Hamas. Since then, the conflict in Gaza has cost tens of thousands of civilian lives. And now,
this is a tipping toward that much broader all-out regional war that many have feared and warned about.
1 year in the shadow of October 7th, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Did you know that the little town of Kona is home to one of the largest queen bee breeders in the world? Well, that fact is part of the storied history of beekeeping on the Big Island that Leandra Rouse is currently writing. She calls it From Humble Hives to Global Impact, the story of Kona's beekeeping. Rouse is the daughter of beekeepers and grew up on a beekeeping farm in Kona. She recently partnered with the Kona Historical Society to turn her writing into an exhibit for visitors and locals alike. She recently made a trip to our station to talk to the conversation's Russell Subiono about the bee's place in Hawaii history.
What is the history of beekeeping in Kona? Yeah, well, it's a really special and unknown history to most people, but it really interplays with agriculture in Kona, which is huge. And even riding in the cab over to your headquarters, the auntie was telling us, you can't find any fresh produce on Oahu. It's so hard to find. And everything that it is, it comes from Hawaii Island. And so bees are such an integral part of that, as are pollinators. And not only is Kona a great exporter of honey, but it's also supporting our coffee, our macadamia nuts, our avocados, all of our fruit and flowers. So it's really big there. And actually, queen bees, honeybees, are not native to Hawaii originally. They are an introduced species. In 1857 was their first attempts. There was a lot of failed attempts. And then it wasn't until the early 1900s that they were really established with more formal beekeeping. Actually, some of the first beekeepers were through Parker Ranch.
Yeah,
and I believe that they were doing that to support their kiawe. So that was some of the first formal beekeepers. And then I know also Greenwell Farms, the coffee producers in Kona, had a big impact in bringing beekeepers over. But what makes Kona so special and unique for honeybees is, well, the Big Island so unique is, one, the climate. It's great weather. Two, on Hawaii Island, we have the 13 different ecosystems. So there's all these different areas where you can raise bees for different climates. Also, for a very long time, Hawaii was an isolated breeding grounds, meaning we didn't have all the pests that were all over the world. So we were able to raise really strong, healthy honeybees while the rest of the world was just getting hit with pest after pest. And the other part that's new information to me about queen breeding in particular is that there's minimal wind in Kona, which is important because they mate in flight.
You mentioned that there were a couple of attempts to bring the bee over. I read one where the first attempt, it was too hot, so the bees died. The second attempt, they packed them in ice.
Too cold,
too cold, right? So where did those first bees originate from? Did they originate from the U.S. or somewhere else in the world?
I was just asking someone about that, and I believe that, you know, originally honeybees came from some part in Asia, but the colony that survived in Hawaii on the third attempt, the just right attempt, was from California. But they're called the German bees. The German bees were the first bees here, and these are called German black bees. Okay. And from what I understand, they are meaner than African bees, a really tough, hard-to-manage honeybee.
Why is this an interesting subject to you?
Well, this story is really close to my heart. I am the daughter of beekeepers, Kona beekeepers. And actually, my parents ended up building a little queen bee operation in Kona called Kona Queen Company. I was raised on that farm, helping stock nukes and make wax boards and all of the, my chores looked a little different than other kids. But Kona Queen ended up being one of the world's largest queen bee producers, actually the world's largest at one point. Wow. So a major international export.
What was it like growing up on a bee farm? Were you integrated into raising the bees at some point? How much do you know about the process of keeping bees?
To be honest, I should know more.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look back and think, why wasn't I more interested in my parents' business at that time? But there certainly were aspects that we participated in. Mm-hmm. Like I used to suit up in my little bee suit and I would help feed the bees. So I'd have, you know, sugars that would go into each hive and go with my dad. But now I'm, as an adult, having more interest in what they're doing. Yeah. So one of the reasons I'm doing this research project is, one, because it's interesting and I want to share it with the Kona community. It's a really neat part of our history. And two, to, you know, honor my parents. It was a really unique life path that they took. And actually, my dad turned 75 this year. So I thought this would be a great time to do something in honor.
What did your parents like about raising bees?
My father originally is from Sacramento Valley, and he's like sixth generation farmer. And he was born on a walnut and a plum farm. And so in his 20s, his brother and him got into pollination because these major producers, especially like almond farmers, they need heavy amounts of pollination. And so his brother and him became bee movers. They would move these hives to the pollinator crops that needed it to help support them in production. And ultimately, that means they're truck drivers, right? Because they're driving up and down California. You got to move bees before the sun is up because that's what keeps them in their hive. So he'd had a lot of hours on the road with my mom as well.
I imagine you probably got stung quite a bit growing up. Do the stings impact you anymore? Do they hurt anymore?
They still hurt, but my dad, you should see him. I mean, he gets stung, you know, at the bee farm, he would say he'd get stung anywhere from, you know, like 3 to 10 times a day. It doesn't impact him. But one more thing just to share about, you know, how my family got into beekeeping. It started in California, but my parents actually came to Hawaii on their honeymoon in the 70s, and they never left. And they visited Molokai, which has a famous honey producer, still one of the biggest honey producers in the U.S. is based on Molokai.
Wow.
And so they visited there, and then they visited Kona, and they ended up getting a job at this little apiary called Kona Queen, and that was the beginning of it. And then they were there. He was there for 40 years.
Is it true that if you get stung when you're pregnant, your kids aren't allergic to bees?
Hey, I told you that. I've heard that. I don't know if it's true, but I can speak for myself. Yeah. I am not allergic. Neither are my children.
You mentioned earlier how conditions were ideal when bees were first introduced. No predators, no pests. We have heard recently so much about invasive pests, things that impact our local agriculture, like the coconut rhinoceros beetle, the coffee bearer borer. We hear a lot about the little fire ant, which I don't think impacts our agriculture directly, but who wants to go work out in a field where the ants are, right? Do our local beekeepers face similar challenges? Is there a local pest that they also have to keep an eye out for?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's major pests in the bee industry. And even if you recall, 15, 20 years ago, there was a lot of talk about save the bees with some of these pests. So we have, unfortunately, in 2007, I believe, and 2008, 2009, about that time, we had both the Varroa mite, which is a tiny mite, as you might imagine, that kills bees, and it's all over the world. We also now have the tiny hive beetle, small hive beetle. And both of those are really, really, really impactful. And unfortunately, yeah, our kind of lax borders in terms of invasive species make a huge impact on our bees.
Working on this sounds like it started as a passion project, but has since grown larger with community interest. Can you talk about the partnership that you have with Kona Historical Society? It sounds like this is turning into something much bigger.
Yeah, I'm writing and capturing the history of bees in Kona in partnership with Kona Historical Society. They actually have a really amazing archive, very professional, climate controlled. And so I'm gathering histories, timeline, and oral histories from different people impacted by the bees in Kona. And then we're partnering to create an exhibit for their museum, which is right in Kealakekua near Greenwell Farms. So we're going to create an exhibit for their museum, which hopefully launches next April in alignment with my dad's birthday. And we'll also be part of, they host something called the Hano Hano Lecture Series. So hoping to bring in, again, ranchers and beekeepers and people impacted and do a panel talking story about bees. And then the last thing they do is they do a Kona Jeep tour. We don't know what it's going to look like yet, but I imagine it'll be a tour of some of the most beautiful bee yards overlooking Kealakekua Bay and just getting to know the history and the relationship between beekeepers and ranchers and farmers.
When somebody is embarking on a project like this, when you're collecting historical information and you're helping to create an archive, I imagine there's always a price tag that comes with it. Is there funding that you guys need to be able to complete this project?
Yes. What started as like a nice birthday card has turned into a big community project. And so in partnership with Kona Historical Society, we are raising funds right now to help us build the exhibit and do the lecture series. I'm about to launch a Kickstarter where community members can contribute. And I love that too, because the Kona community can be part of telling the story and making it happen. So I love kind of like the crowdfunding aspect of that. So yeah, if anybody wants to contribute, they're welcome to reach out to Kona Historical Society. We have a website, historyofkonabeekeeping.com, where you can find some more information.
When we first talked about this, I did not know that Kona was the queen bee capital of the country, of the world. In this research that you've been doing, in your experience in this field, is there another fact or thing about beekeeping here in Hawaii that the public may not know about, what would be kind of cool to hear?
Yeah, something that comes to mind that has come up in interview after interview that feels so special to me and so Hawaii is about the kokua relationships between the ranchers and the beekeepers, because beekeepers run their businesses on other people's land, essentially. So those relationships have to be good. And the stories I'm hearing about the Kona beekeepers, particularly my dad, which makes me proud, is that he opened those relationships up. Someone just told me, when your dad took over Kona Queen, our locations increased by 400%.
Wow.
And he would deliver honey, and he'd sit with the ranchers and talk story and say, hey, how can I help you? Can I rebuild a wall or bulldoze this field for you? And I'm hearing more and more stories about that important relationship, and that so many people have come to Kona and tried to make it, right? They tried to have plantations and sugar in Kona, but it didn't work. But a big part of the success of bees and beekeepers is their relationships. And the kokua aspect, which is special.
Makes sense. I mean, Hawaii's all about relationships, right?
Yeah.
Leandra, so fun talking to you about bees. Thanks so much for coming into the station.
Thank you for having me. Dream come true.
And that was new Big Island bee historian, Leandra Rouse, talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today.
Financial sector is looking at a new customer, the wrongfully convicted.
There are no other options for innocent people getting out of prison. There's no other funding available. There's no loans. So what are they to do?
They're turning to financial firms who provide exonerees with cash, but at interest rates so high, it's like a new kind of confinement. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
When you support HPR, you support locally produced programs featuring locally produced music, including Kani Kapila Sunday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kani Kapila Sunday. I'm Kaylee Iloma, and I'm so happy to be with you again on a Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. to offer you great Hawaiian music from all periods.
Hawaii Kula Iwi.
Aloha nui kako. You are tuned in to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio 1's Hawaii Kula Iwi. Ovo no ke yo, DJ Mermaid, Paige Okamura.
And Mauka Tumakai.
This is Mauka Tumakai. I'm your host, Roger Bong.
Your support brings the music of Hawaii to the world. Support Hawaiian and local music programs on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Symphony has a new president and CEO. Her name is Amy Iwano. And HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio, had a chance to meet with her and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so she hasn't been on the job for very long.
No, she's actually, she started her position in July. That's when the board of directors selected her after outgoing president and CEO Dave Moss stepped down late last year. And I got to sit down with her. So Amy Iwano, she comes from decades of an arts career, about 30 years. She is a musician. She grew up playing the harp and piano. And Amy Iwano, she actually has ties to Hawaii, even though she's originally born and raised in Ohio. Her family, her father grew up on Hawaii Island and her mother on Maui, and she told me that occasionally she would visit her aunties, uncles, and cousins here in Hawaii. And she took on the role, I think now she's about 3 months into the role, so now she's responsible for the overall management of and leadership of the organization. She oversees the finances and operations. Now she's in charge of fundraising and artistic programming, community engagement, and staff management. And she also has to work closely with the music director, Dane Lamb, to map out the orchestra's vision. And part of her goals and her vision is boosting audience attendance and diversifying the sponsorships that the orchestra has. And some of her long-term goals are to grow the nonprofit's programs and conduct more community outreach. She also said she wants the symphony orchestra to perform across the state again, like it did when it was the Honolulu Symphony. That was something new to me because I just knew the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra to be performing mostly on Oahu. And so she also said she wants to broaden access to the orchestra by partnering with schools that have the facilities to support these performances.
Longer term goals, Maestro Dane Lamb and I are looking at how to integrate more education into our programs and community outreach. So broadening our audiences as well as deepening our audiences. We'd like to get back to touring the islands. That's something that the Honolulu Symphony used to do. And we would love to be able to bring our music and the experience of hearing a full symphony orchestra to everybody across the islands. We would like to broaden access to the orchestra for more audiences here in our community. So we're looking at ways to connect with schools, whether that means the orchestra going to different schools or bringing students to our performances wherever they may happen, whether it's in the theater or someplace else. Education is really important. Community outreach, community inreach is sometimes what I call it, is really important. We exist for the community and we need the community to fulfill our mission.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great idea just to really get to our young ears, right, early on.
Yeah, and speaking of young ears, she did speak about the challenges to ensuring that classical music stays relevant, especially among the younger audience. So it's just trying to find that way to make sure that classical music appeals to that younger demographic to get them to be donors later on in the future, while also attracting donors that may be a little bit more wealthy, or just kind of how the nonprofit business works. Is that you have to rely on donors, but specifically for the orchestra, their main source of revenues is from ticket sales. And she did tell me that they're doing pretty good on their ticket sales, but they could be doing better. Another challenge that Amy Iwano says that the orchestra is facing is finding facilities that are adequate enough to host a symphony orchestra. One thing about the orchestra is that if you play at the Waikiki Shell or the Blaisdell, you kind of have that concert that makes sure that they illuminate the sounds to where all the audience can actually hear the music, as opposed to when I asked you, like, oh, what if they played outside or something? Some of those audience may not get the same sound effects, to where if the symphony were to play outside, all of that music just goes up in the air, so you won't get that same sound quality.
Yeah, and, you know, the concert hall has been closed, right, for renovations. And so, yeah, it's been a real adjustment, I think, you know, playing at the Shell and all of that.
Yeah, and Amy Iwano did address that, too. She said the Waikiki Shell has been helpful when the orchestra would play there. But she did say that the Blaisdell is anticipated to reopen again in the next couple of months. So they're really excited to get back there and start playing there again. But it's also, she told me that she's looking for more sponsorships in the neighbor islands, the ones that have the facility. Because she did say one of the challenges that, you know, in order to diversify the audience, is that she noticed that the audience has to come more in town in the Waikiki area, to where she says, oh, that's not fair. What if we just go to Leeward Community College, or what if we go to Moanalua High School, where we go out and bring the orchestra to the community and do more community outreach that way? So that's part of her vision to how she wants to diversify the audience and attract younger audience.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's been, you know, lots of buzz of late, you know, with the hiring of Dane, you know, and yeah, so people are excited and, you know, they've just been offering, you know, wonderful concerts of late that I've attended, just fabulous.
And for the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, when Amy was talking about attracting the younger audience, when you think of classical music, you think of Beethoven, but the orchestra can actually interpret more music. For example, I know if they played, they orchestrated Frozen, for example, the Disney movie Frozen. They also played music of the Star Wars Star Wars theme songs.
Oh, yeah. You're having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but you definitely appeal to that audience and you bring them to just appreciate just a different dimension to the music that they're hearing.
And so Amy does have to come with new ideas, because when Dave Moss, when he was president and CEO, when he came right in the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. And when I was talking to some musicians on Dave Moss's background, they told me that he did a really good job of doing community outreach and knowing that he's not from Hawaii, but he was doing that right away. And he was trying to help grow the revenues of the symphony orchestra. So those are the things that I've heard about Dave Moss before his departure. But the symphony orchestra has faced financial challenges in the past. When it was known as the Honolulu Symphony, it filed bankruptcy in 2009 after the economic crisis, and the revenues decreased during the COVID-19 pandemic, but that's because everything was on shutdown or lockdown, and the ticket sales decreased because no one was really going to concerts like that anymore. And the nonprofit reported revenues of more than $3 million in 2021, and its most recent revenues is now over $5 million.
Wow.
So it's doing a little bit better, but Amy Iwano says their total operation budget is $6 million, but she's still trying to grow that just to get more resources. So she says the symphony orchestra is in good financial stature, but more work needs to be done, especially in boosting their ticket sales. I do know the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra was founded in 1900, which was once known as the Honolulu Symphony. It's the second oldest orchestra in the country, west of the Rocky Mountains. I spoke with Dane Lamb, the music director, about his collaboration with Amy Iwano, and he says they share the same vision as the orchestra.
It's just great that Amy and I share so many passions for how music can be a real change agent, a real agent for transformation in the community. And she also shares mine and the HSO's focus on performing music from Europe, performing Western music, but also growing our programming to embrace our Pacific roots and our Asian roots, and bringing really world-class performers to our islands and exporting this with Hawaii sound everywhere through the world and through the region.
And part of her idea is to really make that the orchestra the orchestra of the Pacific. Some of her ideas is also to either travel to the Pacific Islands, including Japan, or providing these concerts via Zoom or any other type of online event.
Yeah, no, that would be great. It's a very good idea. But yeah, excited to see what she does.
Yeah, so it's within her first year of leadership, so we're going to see what she can do in the next, or especially this concert season.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie. We've been talking with HPR's Cassie Ordonio. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That does it for us today. And with the general election just weeks away tomorrow, we pull the curtain back on the Election Commission. Function or dysfunction? Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.